And hello. Thank you so much for joining us. This is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse at naturalnurse.com. And we love having you with us. Thank you for joining us today right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And today's a special day because Dr. Z and myself are on live with you today. So thanks so much for joining in. Hi, Dr. Z.
Good day, Dr. Kamai. Great to have you and to talk about health, wellness, and alternative medicine today on our great program here. And you can always get information on our fun shops and our talks and walks and books and all kinds of trips that we're doing on our prospective websites, naturalnurse.com and drznaturally.com, because we do a lot of teaching, that's for sure, right, Dr. Kamai?
Yeah, let's just review the wonderful class we actually did. It was exciting because it was the first thing that I did, which was not Zooming. That was actually live with real plants and real people.
Yeah, well, we did a great, what we call a fun shop. I forgot who taught us that word, but anyway, it's kind of funny. You know, people call it a workshop, but when we're out there working with plants and making medicine and teaching people, it almost is it is a lot of fun, that's for sure. So that boundary between work and play and being connected with nature all kind of blurs, and like you get kind of lost track in time, although you're good about our timekeeping.
That's true, because, you know, it has to be, but it's a long workshop. I mean, I think we spent a good 4 hours out there. And in that time, people went home with their own that we prepared ourselves in class. First, we went out and identified and gathered many edible and medicinal plants in the local Long Island area. And then we processed them into actual medicine that works, made out of all natural plants. And the participants got to basically make it themselves and then take it home. So what a fantastic, fun thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, learning that skill, you mentioned before that, you know, about homesteading and kind of the skills that are needed to survive and make food and medicine, and that's an important skill for a lot of people. Week ago, we had Dr. Mike LaPelle talking about that's kind of how people could start sequestering carbon in the soil by doing more organic farming. Even urbanites doing, a nice garden and things like that, growing more food, getting more plants on the planet to get rid of carbon dioxide. It all takes these kind of efforts for us to do. And there's so much old and new information on these things. It's like, you know, this is old stuff, but it's brand new in a way.
Yes, that is true. And it's certainly having a renaissance because as people are seeing and it becomes very real to, you know, things can disappear in a minute. Things like electric, things like grocery store access, things like toilet paper, you know.
Right.
And we're so tied in to wide commercial access for these things. And then, of course, in current times, we get a wake-up call about how fragile that system is. Yet the ancient system of being connected to the land is not fragile.
Yeah, and but for some reason that knowledge gets obscured, and maybe it's not taught by our parents, and my parents taught me some things, that's for sure. You know, I grew up, my dad would always tell me stories of his grandparents in Italy, and a couple years ago I got a chance to go back to the old farm that my dad would talk about from ever since I'm a kid, which actually piqued my interest in natural medicine, one of the many factors that molded me into who I am today. And learning, and I saw his cousin still runs the old farm in Italy, where, you know, they grind polenta, they grind corn to make meal, and they grow so many things. It's just amazing to see that. And I really never experienced that too much. And I know you have, actually, living on, you know, farms in Bisbee, Arizona, and homesteading and doing all those things, goat farming.
That's true, because I actually thought that that would be the only way to survive at some point, back when I did that in the late 60s and 70s. Uh-huh. And it's funny because a lot of the activities that I thought would have occurred then seem to be occurring now. Right. So still knowing those skills is definitely, definitely a plus. And so many people, because of the onslaught of chemicals in our environment and wrong eating, develop all kinds of illnesses. And one of the things we have both seen in our practice for so many decades is an increase in something called autoimmune illness.
Yes, it's become almost a commonplace thing to get either rheumatoid arthritis or lupus or Sjogren's syndrome, which we'll talk a lot about today. As I continue to work on our next book one of these days, maybe when I retire teaching, I'll go really into writing these next part of our book, because we do have a great book on arthritis that's been out there for, you know, almost 20 years, I guess, 15 years or so.
Well, yeah, then it was republished with newer research. That book is still a bestseller, and you can find all our books listed with links of where you can get them, sometimes as audiobooks, as ebooks, as well as full regular hard copy, you know, or soft copy books. And you can go to naturalnurse.com under books. They are all listed there with a click through, including the arthritis book that Dr. Zamperone and I did write, which has a lot of the information we'll be talking about today, because autoimmune illness is much bigger than just arthritis. What's like a list of some of the autoimmune diseases, Dr. Z?
Well, you have ankylosing spondylitis, which affects the spine and the pelvis. Like I mentioned, Sjogren's disease, our kind of superstar we're going to be talking a lot about today, which affects the eyes, the salivary glands, and the joints, but can also affect the organs, too. Rheumatoid arthritis, people have heard about that, I'm sure, quite a bit, which really can affect every organ, but certainly tends to affect the smaller joints. Then you have other ones like lupus, which is a terrible illness which can affect basically every organ in the body, but tends to attack the kidneys and things like that more. And then you have sarcoidosis, which leaves these like lesions in the lungs and all throughout the body. Then you have other ones like polymyositis and dermatomyositis, which attack the muscles. These are autoimmune disease of the muscles. So those are the more common ones. And then there's many, you know, other ones that people can get.
And many people, unfortunately, do find themselves with it. And it takes a long time to get them diagnosed at times, because they have such a wide range of presenting symptoms.
Well, I forgot the real common one, Hashimoto's thyroiditis. That's a very common one now, where the body seems to attack the thyroid, thinking the thyroid is a foreign entity. In all these autoimmune diseases, there's a case of mistaken identity where the body will attack the tissue thinking it's foreign. And in my course that I teach in rheumatology, and in our upcoming book one of these years, and in our webinar that we did with the master class, we spent many, many sessions talking about some of the theories as to why the body can make this mistake. Normally, the body is not supposed to make the mistake. The cells, if a cell turns a little bit strange, the body's immune system is supposed to identify it, and then the cell is supposed to go to commit suicide, I guess. It's sort of like, okay, I'm not listening to the rules. I better just turn myself in, so to speak. And then it goes through apoptosis, they call that, cellular suicide. But an autoimmune disease, you end up with cells that don't listen, kind of like cancer in a way, not as devastating, of course, but they don't listen, and they have all kind, and then they start making almost like cells that are kind of jihadists. They don't listen. They do their own thing. They start creating mayhem, and eventually they start attacking your own body. And we don't know why they attack certain types of the body, although there is some interesting information that Dr. Ebinger, well-known rheumatologist and immunologist, has looked at. And he has looked at the combination of environment, microbiology in the body, and stressors, and created this kind of pyramid, you know, three-part trifecta of perfect storm things that come together to create an autoimmune disease. And that's kind of where we've done a lot of work, looking through the medical literature, looking at the causes of autoimmune disease, because holistic practitioners believe that we want to try to fix the underlying cause, not just develop novel drugs that block the inflammation pathway, because one of the hallmarks of having an autoimmune disease is a lot of inflammation, sometimes pain, and but certainly trying to stop the inflammation has been where the pharmaceutical industry have developed all these novel, what they call biological drugs that do those types of things. But we in natural medicine always try to take a step back and say, well, you know, there's got to be a reason for this inflammation. There's got to be a reason for why the body turned against itself.
Dr. Zieg, that's a very good point. What you're talking about is one of the differences between what you do, naturopathic medicine, highly trained physician in naturopathic medicine. You want, as an overall treatment goal, to find the cause, take several steps back. While in conventional medicine, in an 8-minute visit, all they are interested in doing is just covering the symptom. And how I describe that as an analogy is if your car is driving along, you know, check the oil to see if maybe that's low versus just put a piece of black tape on the light that says there's an engine problem.
Yeah.
And then just keep driving until it seizes, and then you have surgery and replace the engine. So it's a big difference.
That is an analogy. Still, despite the plethora of incredible amount of information published on the National Library of Medicine about the causes of autoimmune disease, this is not stuff that, this is not hocus pocus, you know, woo-woo stuff. This is stuff right from the National Library of Medicine database about the causes of autoimmune disease. They've identified, at least in my course that I teach, at least 30 different reasons for why people develop autoimmune disease. And then, of course, our theory is, well, if we know the reasons, then maybe we can mitigate some of these things and etiologies, as we say in the medicine, and then hopefully bring the body back into balance. And that's what we've seen clinically time and time again. Sometimes it takes a long time to backtrack through time. There's a whole philosophy of healing that Dr. Konstantin Hering talked about. He talked about how we heal from the inside out, from the top down, in reverse chronological order. So healing is a law. There's a law and a logic that it follows. It's not just haphazard. And naturopathic physicians are trained to watch this progression of healing. And other people, too, like Dr. Rekowig, who called it regressive and progressive vicariation. That was what he talked about. But you can, and we have examples of many clinical examples all in our book, our arthritis book, you can reverse these maladies and at least give quality of life to people without using heavy pharmaceuticals that turn off the immune system or destroy the immune system or paralyze the immune system. So it takes a lot of detective work. We can't do it overnight, and quite a bit of laboratory, but I think of myself as kind of like a medical detective, kind of like a little bit like Columbo, a little bit like Monk, because sometimes I stumble and hit a dead end, but we keep trying until we find the underlying cause of the disease.
Right, and it does. What you said is very important, because natural medicine does take more time. How long would you say your usual first intake visit with a patient is?
At least 2 hours.
So at least two hours. Dr. Z, in a conventional medical practice, do you know how many patients a physician needs to see in 2 hours? It's actually mandated something like 8 minutes per visit.
Especially
if they're in an HMO or one of those places that has to see a lot of people. I mean, it's completely different. Think about it. How many doctor's visits has anyone gone to where they're with their doctor for 2 hours? That's not every visit, but certainly for you to establish the rapport and deeply interview the person. What kind of emotional factors are they dealing with? What do they eat? I mean, this is not even addressed in mainstream medicine.
Absolutely. There's been a plethora of information about the role of diet and autoimmune disease. So first, of course, it's the constituents that we eat. There's a whole one of the theories of autoimmune disease is the lectin hypothesis, which, of course, Dr. Peter Diadamo, one of my gurus, and I did a residency with him when I first started out and worked in his office in Greenwich for a couple years. When I first started out 30 years ago in naturopathic medicine, he taught us that lectins can stimulate inflammation. It's called the complement pathway. This is a pathway, if you read any pathology book, they talk about the complement pathway. It's a way that your body revs up and gets ready for a fight. And by eating the wrong types of lectins, and a lot of that is determined by your cell surface markers, or i.e. your blood type, you can stop instigating the body to be inflamed all the time. So Dr. Diadamo has done a lot of work looking at this and which lectins can inflame the body and which lectins seem to leave the body alone, and it's very individualized. So the patient will bring in their diet and we'll take a look at it and see if there's any causation that we see with diet and inflammation and the genesis of autoimmune disease. Then secondly, diet plays a big role in your flora. Studies have shown that if you change your diet, your flora often changes with that, and the flora is...
I was going to say, what's the flora? You're using that term.
Flora is, you know, I always give the analogy that the bacteria and fungi and yeast and even some viruses that live in your body, some are very friendly, some are what we call commensal, which they don't really do you any good and they don't do you any bad. They just take up like niche space, if we use a biological term. And then some are pathogenic, bad. They cause disease. And so like your front lawn or like the rainforest, it's a delicate balance of these species vying for resources, whether that's, in the rainforest, it's light. On your front lawn, it's the weeds, the chickweed, the dandelions, the crabgrass, fighting with the bluegrass and the rye and the zoysia and all these other grasses that are the plantain, of course. So this delicate balance exists. But when one of these organisms becomes the more dominant organism in the body, that can cause autoimmune disease. And this was very well put by Dr. Ebinger's work, where he actually found that people who have this particular type of arthritis called, ankylosing spondylitis, which is, again, a spinal arthritis, they actually have an overgrowth of this bug called Klebsiella, which lives in their colon. And the Klebsiella produces toxins and proteins that exactly match the proteins of the collagen, which is, the thing that makes up our joints, the collagen in the body. So when the Klebsiella makes these toxins, the body thinks that the Klebsiella is itself, and vice versa. So you basically get this problem where this overgrowth of the bacteria exists, and then there's some genetic markers at play. And the bottom line is you go down the road developing spinal arthritis. Now, what he showed is if you change your diet and get off of starch, white flour, pasta, potatoes, things like that, that stymies the growth of the Klebsiella, and by stopping the growth or slowing the growth, you slow the progression of the disease. How amazing is that, that food is medicine, and medicine is food, and your choice of what you're eating is making a direct impact, not on just your gut, but on your joints. Fascinating stuff.
Yes, and it's also logical. The thing is, I think a lot in conventional medicine does not discuss that because of politically the concept of the fact that doctors are the only ones who know anything and they are in control, not something simple like diet, that the only thing you can do is a pharmaceutical solution, which could not be further from the truth. Now, certainly integrating regular conventional pharmaceuticals in a treatment plan is something you even often recommend. Or if someone comes in already on a plethora of pharmaceuticals, we don't say just stop those, but
right.
We will start to change what the cause of the disease is. And then working with the physician who prescribes those pharmaceuticals, get off them. Because very often, not only don't they cure the disease, they make it worse, or they cover a symptom but cause a degradation in overall health. So it's just not a good answer.
Well, we've seen that when a patient comes in and they're on a bunch of drugs, we put it in different programs. Like there's that one program, the MyTavin that we talked about, and other ones, where you put the drugs in and you click the button on your computer and it tells you what nutrients those drugs are stripping from your body, depleting from your body.
What's the name of that program, Dr. Z? Can people just look it up?
Yes, MyTavin, MyTavin. I think that's the spelling, yeah. Yeah, just go to MyTavin.com. we have a whole other PowerPoint that we did on that. And this drug nutrient depletion is a very fascinating field that I think pharmacists more have talked about, not physicians, because, you know, in conventional medicine, you have pharmacists interacting with physicians, interacting with nurses and nurse practitioners, so you have this whole interplay. Whereas in holistic medicine, oftentimes the prescribing doctor is the pharmacist and does the role of discussing the medicine or nutrients or nutraceuticals that are used, so there's not this. So we're responsible. When I tell someone to take an herb, I'm responsible to discuss with the patient the side effects of the herb, the interactions, and the drug nutrient depletion. So I want to work on all that and show people that when they're taking, for instance, when they're taking aspirin for aches and pains for their arthritis, that it's stripping the body of vitamin C and so many nutrients. There's a whole host of them. And if they don't take the extra C, they're in a deficit, and that's going to catch up with them and worsen their disease.
Well, certainly, if someone comes to you, you're going to send them for a nutrient analysis and all kinds of advanced testing that you're not going to get. Like, I know you're fund of the organic acid analysis and nutrient analysis. Why would you run those tests?
Well, it turns out that nutrients are the way that the body innately heals itself. And every nutrient has a very powerful physiologic action on the body. And so the knowledgeable practitioner who understands the physiological action of the different nutrients on the body could realize that sometimes the very symptoms people are presenting with are from the dearth or deficiency of that particular nutrient. So go back to aspirin again. So you're taking aspirin or one of the what they call non-steroidal drugs, Celebrex, there's different ones out there. All of them are the same way, Tylenol, ibuprofen. They all are antagonists to vitamin C. But what does that have to do with the joints? Well, vitamin C is intimately involved in the synthesis of collagen. Well, collagen is part of your joints, part of your cartilage, part of your ligaments. So here you have a collagen inflammatory disease like rheumatoid arthritis or one of the other ones we talked about already. And here you're taking a drug that helps you with the pain, but almost diabolically stripping your body of the collagen because it's interfering with vitamin C, the very thing that you need to get well. It's almost like, it's almost crazy that people will take these things, but yet, like candy, people take this NSAIDs like candy.
Because the doctors are recommending it.
All right, so we're back on. So let's talk about Sjogren syndrome. So Sjogren syndrome turns out to be the second most diagnosed autoimmune disease that's around. So when I was researching it, I was fascinated by that it is very common. And, of course, it was named after Dr. Hendrik Sjogren, who was an ophthalmologist, who back in 1933 saw a triad of symptoms and connected them. So that was great. He saw that these things affected the eyes, of course, being an ophthalmologist, and the salivary glands, and also the joints and the organs. And so they looked at, you know, they took biopsies of people's glands around their, you know, that make saliva, and found that they were inflamed and they had a lot of white blood cells infiltrated inside the glands, almost as if the white blood cells were trying to attack an infection. But they could not find any microorganisms in there. And it was officially recognized as an autoimmune disorder many years after Dr. Sjogren talked about 30 years later. They finally put it in the autoimmune books that this is an official autoimmune disease. But it's a chronic autoimmune disorder, which is characterized by complaints of very dry eyes and very dry mouth, and eventual destruction of the glands of the eyes and mouth, as well as systemic wide rheumatoid complaints. And then that also it can attack not only the joints but other organs there. So they, and like I said, they see that there's weird looking B and T cells, which are types of white blood cells that are involved in our immune system, where they actually make too much inflammatory substance, and they're going into the area of the joints, of the organs, of the salivary glands and the eyes, thinking that there's a viral or bacterial infection. Now, there might be a virus involved with that. They're still researching the cause of Sjogren syndrome. But it can affect all kinds of things. People in women, it can cause vaginal dryness and painful intercourse. In people, it can cause digestive problems because you can't make enough digestive enzymes. Of course, the dry mouth and the mouth sores can cause your teeth to decay very quickly. And the dry nose can cause recurrent sinusitis, nosebleeds. The dry eyes can cause you to tear your cornea and cause more infections in the eye. That's because mucus, Dr. Kamai, mucus is not just a thing that we blow our nose when we're sick. Mucus is a very protective substance. It has all of these. It's our first layer of defense. You know, now we're all worried about COVID, and our guest a couple weeks ago talked about that if we looked at the mucus in patients and we could look at how much secretory IgA, which is an immunoglobulin which stops infections, we could kind of see how healthy people are instead of just measuring their disease. And so that's kind of, again, how naturopathic doctors think, holistic doctors think. Then, of course, Sjogren's can cause bronchitis and arthritis, too. So it's a real problem. Now, of course, there's many reasons for why people can have dry eyes. Sometimes they live in the desert. Sometimes they're not drinking enough water. Sometimes they are on drugs like antihistamines and diuretics and things like that, which causes them to excrete too much water. Sometimes they're low in essential oils because your tears in your eye somewhat are made out of oils and somewhat made out of water. So you want the tears to have a good balance of water and this layer of oil. And so they've done research and found out that patients with Sjogren's syndrome have very low omega-3 oils. Those are the real healthy oils that we get from flaxseed, walnuts, fish, and things like that. So that's some of the background on Sjogren's syndrome. Sometimes they can progress to, unfortunately, lymphomas and Hodgkin's disease. So that's why it's important to catch these things. They found these abnormal B cells. Now, B cells are like one of those cells that stimulate the antibodies to be made in the body. So when you have the body reacting and making so many B cells, like a factory gone wild, what happens is the B cells can mutate. And then one of these mutant B cells can go on to form a type of cancer, like Hodgkin's disease or lymphoma. So they found a lot of these things in the patients with the Sjogren's syndrome. And some people feel that there's viral etiologies, that someone gets, a virus, and then somehow there's a case of mistaken identity. The virus looks a lot like the saliva glands. And so when the immune system attacks the virus, it makes the mistake of then attacking the salivary glands because they look so similar. There's a very similar protein that they found. And that's some of the background on Sjogren's syndrome. But they get a lot of what they call comorbidities. A lot of things happen to them because they're not making enough stomach acid, enough saliva. You would think that would not be important, but saliva is very important for digestive system and the first part of our immune system, like I mentioned before. So they get a lot of these problems, these chronic illnesses that plague them throughout their lives if they don't really get a handle on these types of things. Like candida, for instance. They've did a study in the Journal of Otolaryngology that they found that patients with Sjogren's have a huge amount of candida fungus growing in their body. It's not just limited to the mouth, but it can be throughout the whole digestive tract. Now, is that a cause or an effect? The researchers didn't really know. But we know as holistic practitioners that having an overgrowth of yeast chronically in the body can be a cause of autoimmune disease. So that's another interesting finding that was found. And this is the most interesting finding that many years ago, I studied with the renowned Dr. Serafina Corsello, as did you, work with her. And she told me a lot about patients that don't make enough stomach acid in their digestive system, and that goes on to cause a whole plethora of malabsorption syndromes and problems with absorbing their nutrients. Well, they actually found that patients with Sjogren's have an autoimmune disease that attacks the cells in the stomach that make hydrochloric acid. And this was discovered in 1991. So they're going to go on, if you don't get this syndrome under control, to make less and less and less hydrochloric acid. Well, that's a very important part of your stomach acid. It keeps you free from diseases because the stomach acid will like neutralize the diseases, and then of course it goes ahead and helps you digest your food. And without stomach acid, you can't digest proteins that great. And proteins help build your body. They build collagen. The amino acids build muscle. They're important for neurotransmitters. So you can see how fundamentally you need to support these things. This is all based on science. This was discovered in 1991. So now they've discovered some herbs that seem to help with Sjogren's syndrome. It's interesting. One of the herbs actually became a drug, Dr. Kamai. It's so fascinating when herbs from the rainforest make their way from the pharmacognosists and then brought into the laboratory and then made into a drug. And this drug that comes from the rainforest is called Pilocarpus jabirundi, which is one of the many plants that have become a drug. It's known as, with the active ingredient is pilocarpine. And this is where both naturopathic doctors and conventional doctors would both use this. I would actually use the herb, and they would actually use the synthetic drug. But there was a study, oral pilocarpine for the treatment of both the ocular, the eye, and the mouth symptoms in patients with Sjogren's. 12-week controlled study published in 2003, Annals of Rheumatic Disease. And they showed that this pilocarpine had very beneficial effects. It didn't cure them, but they were able to make lots of saliva and eye fluid, tears, and that was very helpful to monitor them. And they had some side effects. Like,
so does this plant, I'm looking at a picture of that plant. Does it have a common name that people would recognize, or is it actually called Pilocarpus?
Yeah, no, they call it jabirundi. That's the name that the local people from the mountains in Colombia call it. Yeah, jabirundi. But, that's one of the things. Now, the other one is there are plants that make more saliva in your mouth. Echinacea is one of those plants. There's also another one called Spilanthes and another one called Prickly Ash. These are ones
When we look at Spilanthes, that's an entire species. And it's a common plant, especially in Florida.
Spilanthes grows down there. Cool. I know they changed the name. The new name is Acmella, A-C-M-E-L-L-A, but I always call it Spilanthes still. And these things have fascinating chemicals that stimulate the nerves in your tongue to then send a message to the brain and then back a feedback loop, very similar to how cayenne pepper or cinnamon or ginger and some of these other spices will also make saliva. So these are good for patients with Sjogren's syndrome to be using. But when you put some of this prickly ash on your tongue, it is amazing how much saliva is made. And they found the chemical, it's called neoherculin. So that's a good one that I use there. And we want to also correct the vitamin deficiencies that they found in Sjogren's syndrome. They found that they're low in iron and B12, and, of course, all the fat-soluble vitamins are very important, vitamin D and vitamin E, very important. And antioxidants, I remember Dr. Bastier saying that autoimmune disease at the level of the cell, basically, if you get down to the nitty-gritty of the cell, there's too much free radicals destroying the cell. Well, what free radicals are like oxygen that causes rust, for instance, on metal. So when we have not enough antioxidants in our body, we end up with damaging things like DNA and proteins and our cell membrane, and then our cells don't work. And if our cells don't work, they die. So one of the things that they found is to use lots and lots of antioxidants in the diet and lifestyle. And, of course, some of the strongest antioxidants are our berries and resveratrol and all the cabbage family, vegetables, sprouts. One of the Ann Wigmore, one of the old-time naturopaths that I know you studied with, said that sprouts contain one of the highest level of antioxidants. Well, guess what? She's right, because guess what the supplement industry makes many antioxidants out of? Sprouts. They use, like, melon sprouts and other sprouts like that. I read that. That was fascinating. So eating more sprouts. I have a bunch of them in my sprout tray ready for lunch today. Other vitamin deficiencies need to be corrected, too. There's some studies that N-acetylcysteine, which is a sulfur-containing antioxidant, was very important. This was in the Scandinavian Journal of Rheumatology, 1986, double-blind crossover study of taking NAC, that's what they call it for short, by the way, NAC for Sjogren's, showing it was very effective. So again, I like to correct the vitamin deficiencies with flavonoids, dark chocolate, for instance, goji berries, alpha-lipoic acid, making sure you're getting lots of carrots and squash and good veggies to get your antioxidants up there, too. And don't forget the nuts and seeds, because they're where you're going to get the EFAs, the omega-3. Some of the studies, like I mentioned, showed that the patients with Sjogren's had very little amount of omega-3s. And in one study, they tried giving evening primrose oil, which is an omega-6, and it didn't really do anything to help the patient's inflammation, only the omega-3 oils. So I think there's a lot of sources of omega-3, like purslane, walnuts. What's your favorite source of omega-3?
Yeah, well, purslane's excellent, definitely, in terms of a vegetarian source of omega-3s, but not everybody knows how to find that. So actually eating foods that are high, like avocados, have quite a few vegetarian omega-3s, but some of our best sources are definitely in fish.
Right.
Like if people will eat sardines, those are really high, and plus the sardine is such a small fish that it does not accumulate a lot of the toxic chemicals and heavy metals like a larger fish might, such as salmon. And if you're going to choose salmon as a source of omega-3s, in most cases you're wasting your time and money, because if it's farm-raised, it's been raised in a little teeny container and fed fake food, let's say, you started out with to begin with. If you have these illnesses, you're usually eating a lot of fake food, and so is the salmon that's commercially farm-raised. So you really need wild salmon like you would find up in the north west part of the country. So it's not always so easy to get in a regular diet.
Right, that's a good point.
Now, Dr. Z, talk about prickly ash bark, because when we study the old herbalists, that is one of the plants that is so widely used in the older herbal formulations, although you don't see it as much now, but it also has many essential oils in it.
Well, like I said, the prickly ash bark really, really increases the saliva. It's a sialagogue, and it causes the firing off of the calcium neural pathways in the tongue, which then sends a message to make more saliva. So even though you're destroying, you know, they're unfortunately destroying some of the salivary glands, you can kind of almost regenerate them with using your antioxidants and your sialagogues. That's the fancy word that they use in herbal medicine to show an herb that makes more saliva. So that's a good one, prickly ash. I don't know if that's endangered, because I know the ash tree has the ash borer, so I'm not really sure from a herbal perspective about that. You're not damaging the plant. When they harvest these, they just basically get the branches. They don't kill the tree. So, yeah, prickly ash is a good one. I like that.
Oh, you're right. There is some concern with over-harvesting and, the environmental actions with that particular tree. But it is a great old-fashioned remedy.
Right. Now, there's some interesting stuff coming from some of the traditional Chinese medicine, and there was one amazing study using peony. Now, we love peony. Peony is a plant, you know, for those that live in the Northeast, at least, where I live, peony, usually flowers in May, and it's gorgeous, beautiful smell. But the root of the peony, they did an amazing study in China where they looked at to see how the peony worked, and they compared it to a drug that's been in the news lately, hydroxychloroquine. Because, by the way, the anti-malaria drugs, which, you know, were touted to work with COVID but didn't seem to, you know, do that much, are basically a way of suppressing the immune system, which is kind of interesting because they're using it to fight a virus with COVID, so I don't really know that. But nonetheless, that was the control group that they took Plaquenil, hydroxychloroquine, and they found that the it took about 6 months or so, but the peony was great in helping patients with Sjogren's syndrome. They had better saliva. They had better, other secretions of all over the place, less dryness in the body. And it's interesting. When I put some patients on peony, it actually did affect their hormones because I want to check the hormone levels. And believe it or not, their hormones did increase. We saw changes in their progesterone and pregnenolone, some of these hormones that indeed do increase moisture in the body. They would increase vaginal secretions and they increase hormones. That's why you're able to test hormones in the saliva for pregnancy. You know, that is an old test that they developed there. So peony is one of these things that we possibly can do. Now, in allopathic medicine, they use cyclosporin, which is a derivative, believe it or not, from the mushroom. In naturopathic medicine, we use cordyceps. And cordyceps is an amazing mushroom which tends to balance the immune system, whether it's hyper or hypo. So cordyceps is one of those amazing ones that we use for that. And then there's another formula.
Wait a minute. Let's talk more about cordyceps because that there's so many new studies coming out about it, and it's an amazingly interesting thing because it's not exactly a plant. So let's talk about what it is, but they're starting to make vegan cordyceps and grow it from mushroom base.
In the old days, the cordyceps was a group of fungus that would infect insects and caterpillars, and then it would consume the caterpillars, just like the movie Alien, and then it would just like pop out of the insect, like Alien popped out of people's stomachs in the movies. Kind of grotesque. It's amazing, Mother Nature.
It sounds grotesque, but it's amazingly healing for so many people. In fact, I use it as a general tonic, especially in the elderly.
Well, we went on to form a formula called T-Cell Balance, which has the cordyceps in it, standardized cordyceps, which is a mainstay for the use in autoimmune disease with that formula. But it's interesting that that's how cyclosporin, which is a main drug for autoimmune disease and getting a new kidney and things like that, was discovered from that mushroom. A lot of great things from mushrooms, that's for sure. I think mushrooms are also going to be very important to keep people healthy during different pandemics. But nonetheless, another one that's very important to consume all the time is the goji berry. There were some studies that the goji berry combined with chrysanthemum, which we see on our Chinatown tours a lot, and Romania, which is the main herb in China that builds the yin or the fluid in the body, was also very successful for Sjogren's syndrome. And one of my favorite plants that's kind of new is called lily turf. We were able to find this tincture from David Winston's company, lily turf. And this if they did a Cochrane analysis where they looked at all the different formulas that were used in Chinese medicine to clear dryness and moisten the lungs and moisten the body for Sjogren's syndrome, and they found that by far this Mai Men Dong, it's the tuber or the root of this particular type of lily turf, which, by the way, grows all over Long Island. They plant it as an ornamental. They also call it monkey grass. If you go on Google Image and you look up lily turf, this was the most important herb for helping Sjogren's syndrome. So that's kind of the, and I also like to use other mushrooms, reishi, maitake, shiitake, to help with Sjogren's syndrome. So there's a lot to offer that we can do for this autoimmune disease and many autoimmune diseases.
So why don't we think about one of your clients who came in, perhaps with a diagnosed Sjogren's or just a realm of several of these symptoms, and how they progressed. We only have a few minutes left, but if you can do that in a, you know, sort of synopsis, so we see what kind of person this might be helpful for.
Well, one of the interesting things was that you don't see a lot of these autoimmune diseases in men, Dr. Kamai. For some reason, they seem to be very skewed towards more women, like I think there's a 10 to 1. And that has to do probably with the suppressive effects of testosterone and what they call androgens, the androgenous hormones like DHEA, on autoimmune disease. This is something that we talk a lot about in our work, that we our master class on autoimmune disease that people can subscribe to, doctors listening, nurses. But anyway, so this guy came in, 70-year-old guy, and I could tell that he was going through what we call menopause or andropause, and he had Sjogren's syndrome. And again, it's more rare in men. So the first thing I'm thinking is, I got to test this guy's testosterone and DHEA levels. And of course, they were very, very low, and his estrogen levels were very, very high.
Now, Dr. Z, would a conventional doctor even look there?
Well, it's all from the conventional literature.
I know, but they
but
don't
I don't think
do
that
it.
They that they would look there. And that's funny because I had to actually work with a conventionally trained doctor because that's what the guy's insurance did. And he was open-minded enough to let me run some of the laboratory through him, and he was shocked to find out that everything that I talked about was totally correct, that the guy had very little testosterone. And I think things are changing. Doctors are finally figuring out that men go through andropause, as they say. But nonetheless, restoring, he had dry eyes, dry in the morning, dry mouth, could not moisten his mouth for food, sensation of dryness, and the fascinating thing is he had no thirst, too. The guy just never drank water, which I think was part of the behavioral part of the pathology. So, so we changed his steroidal output, and we put him on herbs that actually increase testosterone. One good one is called macuna, the velvet bean, and that increases the testosterone. And we also wanted to give his liver some herbs so that he can break down estrogen very quickly. So by boosting his testosterone, and then we gave him like the same thing we talked about, the prickly ash, the peony, the lily turf, and some of these herbs, he's doing great. He still has Sjogren antibodies, so he still has the disease, but he's able to manage it without any pharmaceuticals. And lately, from running his lab work, his Sjogren antibodies are getting less and less. So I think over time, his body will win the battle and recover from this autoimmune disease. And then we could use the word cure, which medicine doesn't like to use that word. It's a dirty word.
So appropriate, just so appropriate. So Dr. C, we've discussed really tons of in-depth information. And just as a recap, it has to do with the fact overall that the whole approach in natural medicine is much more deep and much more focused on what caused the dysregulation or imbalance, rather than just name a disease and then have a list of prescriptions, even though each of those prescriptions, although they might change a number, do not necessarily give you back good health. Yet using a change in food, in emotional work such as meditation and Tai Chi, and a change in diet, along with a vast array of proven natural interventions, which are not without side effects, we're not saying that, but they have a much better adverse effect profile. And that's why this should be mainstream medicine. It should be the first intervention that everyone gets. And right. Then, if needed, go to pharmaceuticals and surgery and those kinds of interventions.
The patient had great changes by increasing his testosterone. So other, what I call good side effects, happened. So it was wonderful to see.
Yeah, that's exactly good medicine, which you are truly a master of. So I want to thank all our listeners for listening to us today here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And you can always get in touch. And if you like this show, it will be on our archive. So you just go to naturalnurse.com, media, radio shows. We have thousands of radio shows there posted for your listening pleasure, or you can go to prn.fm. And until next time, this is Ellen Kamite, The Natural Nurse.
And Dr. Z saying, stay healthy, folks.
Stay healthy.
Bye-bye.